Okay, we're at the bottom of Beis Amud Beis. It's pretty smooth sailing tonight. It's one of these Gemaras that I thought of skipping it, but I know Ben doesn't like to skip anything. So here we go. Oh, did we leave off in the middle last time? No, we finished up this Indian about... Yes. No. We it was a it got into this topic of Samuch Venira, which will be returned to later, depending on how long we continue with the Masechta, we will get to it or not. But here, three lines from the bottom. Chamtel Tavari is one meal. In other words, this is I was in the middle of a thought when we stopped. For the people that listen online, they have to understand that the shiur goes until Maariv. So we have a hard deadline. Like, it's not possible to, like, keep people, say, oh, you know, like give me just another minute, let me finish my thought. The bell rings, we have to end, because we go straight into Maariv. So, I wonder who's listening to these recordings. the only person that ever listens to the recordings are you, and you're here. I presume you're not reviewing. Anyway, so Chamtel Teferi, because we want to know, like, how far away an outlying suburb to a walled city is to be considered Samuch Venira. So the Gemara says the distance from Teveria to a place called Chamta, which then the Gemara says is a mil. So first of all, Chamta is probably... No, Chamaka there is much further away. But one of the hot springs. You go up to Teveria. When you're going up into Teveria, before you get into the main part of Teveria, they have the ancient hot springs. So the Teveria of old is in the southern part of the city. You know, like when you drive into Teveria, you can still see those... I don't know what period those walls are from. They're not from the times of Yehoshua ben Nun. But they're... They're old walls. You can see the walls from some period of the old part of Tiberias. When you go up further, like past the hotels and past, what's that restaurant? The pagoda. And you get up into the newer part of the city that's more up on the hill, that's modern Tiberias. But ancient Tiberias was in the southern part of what Tiberias is today. And somewhat to the south of that was a place called Chamta, which is where the hot springs still are. Like down there by like the Kever Rabbi Meir Balanes or something like that. So the Gemara says, what's the point of saying this? The answer to the question is what?
The answer to the question should be specific distance.
Yeah, a meal. And the Gemara says it's a meal. Yeah, right. So if it's a meal, why does it tell you from Teveria to Chamta?
Right. Because not everybody understands what a meal is. But you might understand, right. I know the distance between Chamta and Teveria. I would think actually more people understand what a meal is. But...
I mean, if you ask me, what is the, if you ask me, how far is a kilometer? If I tell you it's the distance from Mishkan Tzipora to the Shul and Geffen.
You would be wrong.
Yeah. Okay. Far more than that.
To the round shul.
Yeah. To the round shul. Okay. I'm very bad with distance. And I'm now illiterate. What's illiterate means you can't read. Innumerate means you can't do math. What is the word for somebody who can't measure distance?
Immeasurable.
Immeasurable. I'm immeasurable. In both languages. In both languages. I'm immeasurable in miles and in kilometers. And as it used to be, I knew miles. Like I was like Fahrenheit and Celsius. Also, I just can't figure it out. So. So Nagid, so if you want to know how much is a kilometer, so I can tell you it's from Mishkan Tzipora to the Round Shul. Mm-hmm. But that's only relevant, really, for people that live, in relation to these two synagogues. It might even be meaningless to somebody who lives in Rimon, and it would certainly be meaningless to anybody who lives outside of Efrat. But if I told you that a kilometer is 1,000 meters... And a meter is...
But we would have to know what a meter is.
Say this, I tell you, a meter is, roughly... a meter is roughly one amah. plus or minus. That's, in other words, what's the point of telling you this specific geocentric detail about Tiberia, which is only going to be relevant to people that live in between Tiberia and Lechemta? It's to establish a quantity of a shi'ur. In other words,
why couldn't you just say, you know, 500 amos?
You could establish quantity of shi'ur by saying year, so it still doesn't add. What does it add?
To 2,000 amos.
Well, yeah. 2,000 amos.
What does it add?
No, so it adds an objective measure. In other words, just like in D.C., they have at the you know, the Bureau of Weights and Measures, they have the objective foot and the objective pound and the objective ounce and whatever in terms of establishing weights and measures. And the atomic clock is the official time for all things. I mean, now, we spoke about this not long ago, this question about measuring time. Time used to be very subjective. Was that last week? Really? Yeah. In this context? No. So it's to tell you a meal and what is a meal. So if you need to ever measure a meal for whatever purposes, so you can go and, you know, like, there's a question, you know, besides the fact that there's a question about all of our shiurim, you know, which have been inflated, and this has to do with, you know, a variety of things in modernity, and, you know, how many olives are in a zayit, and how many eggs are in a betza, and etc. We're coming up on Pesach, right?
How many seeds are in a rimon?
Right, we're coming up on Pesach, where we eat like an unreasonable amount of food in an unreasonably
short period of time.
Yeah, it's like a funny thing. Like, you know,
how come the time became shortened and everything else became?
No, because in other words, the machmir on both sides. I mean, it's probably not physically possible to be Yotze Kol HaDeot and to swallow that much matzah in that amount of time if you go going to all the chumras. I mean, like, there's always like a yeshiva guy that like tries to do it, but it's like watching, you know, the hot dog eating contest. So
my brother,
it never ends well.
Brisker.
Agnon has a story. There's two brothers. One's a Chassidish mystic, and the other's a Kalta Litvak. And they meet, you know, this one walking to his Beit Midrash, and that one walking to his Klois on the first day of Pesach. And the Chassidish Yid says, "Oh, Mamish, last night by the Seder, we had all the kavanas for the karpus and for the yachatz and for the you know, about the sviro del yonot when you eat the matzah and everything else." He says, what kavanas did you have? So he said, "I'm a Yehudi Pashut. I had kavana to be Yotzei Dechova." So the Chassidish said, "Oi! Mirov kavanot shechachti kavana." So that's the point of the Gemara. To tell you there's an objective measure of a meal. If you ever have to check it, go and measure from Chamta to Tiberia. Unfortunately, we don't have those two mile markers anymore that can show you precisely what it is. But in the excavations that have been done in and around Harabayit, so we know from the Mishnayos and Midot that there are certain objective measurements that are given in the Mishnayot. And it seems that we now have those actual archaeological markers. And in theory, we could recreate the... Right? In other words, there's a machlokas about how big a tefach is, how big an amma is, how big a anything is. And those are, and all of the shiurim are all interconnected.
You have to go by the Harbak. The debates now, they found like the Chafetz Chaim's Kiddush Cup.
That's something else.
That really counts. That right.
Seder, but all that can tell you is that that's what the Chafetz Chaim thought was a reasonable shiur.
No, but saying even on that.
Right.
Is that like the question of halachic importance?
So we would be more machmir than the Tanayim. Okay, now the Gemara says, V'omer Rebbe Yirmiya, V'itemer Rebbe Chiya. Now this Gemara has nothing to do with the previous Gemara, except for the fact, you can drink all that.
No.
Except for the fact that No, in other words, he already had a statement of Rabbi Yirmiyah v'itema Rabbi Chiya. So here's another statement where we're not sure if it's Rabbi Yirmiyah or Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba. Mansapach. Mem nun tzadi pe kaf. What's interesting about those otiot? Don't say.
Sofiot.
Those are the otiot sofiot.
What? That was obvious. That was interesting.
Right, so in other words, these are all the otiot. Here, look on the blackboard. That have a final form. That when they appear at the end of the word, they appear differently. My daughter sent me a WhatsApp today that said, Samech Aleph Fe, Sofit. I had no idea what she was saying. What was she talking about? Samech Aleph Fe, Sofit. So I called her. I said, what are you talking about? She said, I said, what did you write to me? She said, sup, like what's up? So I pointed out there's no such thing as a pei sofit. In other words, this letter in Hebrew, there's no such thing as a pei sofit. There's no Hebrew word that ends with the sound pa. If you what?
And if there is, and if
trend, spell trend. Trend. With a, we don't spell trend with a, with
but
a
it's not spelled with a pei.
It's not a Hebrew word.
It's oh, used. It's used with a pei. You say in writing, I use the regular form, and not the sofit form.
Because if you write a pei sofit, it has to be a fa. Not a puff.
As in Jeff.
And you can't find a
tramp. As in Jeff.
Oh, would that be
Doc?
Jip.
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 Like how would you spell Trump?
They spell
about what you'd like.
with a pace of feet. That's not the biggest problem. So these otiot.
Oh, nice. I'm happy.
Sofim Amuram, not Bnei Akiva, not Ezra.
Sofim.
Who are the Sofim? Rashi says the Nevi'ei Hadorot. A nickname for the Nevi'im, for the prophets, is Sofim, because you know they saw things. Meaning that the Nevi'im are the ones that establish that these letters have these final forms. Vatisper? Does that make sense? That can't be. And as what's the implication?
That they weren't there previously.
That in the pristine Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote on Har Sinai, or on the Luchot HaBrit, there were no otiot sofiot. V'achtiv, eileh ha-mitzvot. The Pasuk says, Eileh ha-mitzvot. The Gemara wants to learn out Eileh ha-mitzvot. Eileh, the things that are written here in the Torah, She'ein navi rashai l'chadesh davar, me'ata.
Ah, so in other words, if they weren't at the time of
the Luchot, of Matan Torah, the Nevi'im couldn't, as the Gemara.
Not even the length, not even the way a letter works.
Yeah, so the Gemara wants to say that the Nevi'im could not have interfered with the graphic design of the Torah. This Gemara is completely ignoring which essential fact?
What form which script the Torah
yeah,
letters
that,
actually look like?
That a different Gemara that says that the our script, which is called Ashuri, not Ivrit, that our letters are not the original font of the Hebrew language.
It's a Mishnah in Megillah.
Yeah. So it's obviously there was some kind of change, and according to tradition, who instituted that change? Ezra. Long time after Matan Torah. Va'od ha'amar of Chizda mem v'samech shebaluchot benes hayu omdim. But the Gemara says that what was the problem? On the Luchot HaBrit, the Luchot HaBrit were engraved. Choch tochut. Right? The letters were carved out. And not how far into the Luchot were they carved?
All the way through.
All the way through. So that if you held up the Luchot, this is what the letters looked like. So you can see here, this is what a mem would look like. I'd imagine that there's some thickness here. But okay, so we can understand that. Right? You could see this any place. But how would you make a mem or a samach?
Because it would fall out.
Because you would need something to hold in the... So that was a nes. That the mem and the samach were engraved all the way through.
Meaning that the final letters...
I thought you could read it from both sides anyway, so all the letters had to be nes.
What?
I thought you were able to read it from both sides.
In any event...
So that's a different... No, that's not what the Gemara here says. That's not what the Gemara here says.
Different Gemara, different nes.
Right. So in order for this little... The little spitz in the middle of the mem and the samach to be holding... It had to be a nes. Remember when I was a kid, we had these stencils, right? And the stencils for letters that had like a B or a D or an O that have in English that thing. So they'd have to have like a little spitz here to hold it together. And I always thought that was very unaesthetic. But in the Luchot, you didn't have that, so. So, but what do we learn from this Agada about the Otiot? That obviously the final form, in other words, it had to have been at the time of the Luchot, otherwise there's no miracle.
It wouldn't have been in it.
So maybe what does it mean? In Mehavehavu. So that's the way it must have been. They must have had the Otiot Sofiot at the time of the Matan Torah. Velo Havu Yadi. Hai be'emtza teva v'hai be'sof teva. So what do we say? What do we say? What did the Nevi'im do? It's not that they invented the Otiot Sofiot. Yes, it's true. The Otiot Sofiot had to be there in the Luchot. But what? They didn't know which was the Sofit and which was the Emtza'it. Which letters came at the end and which letters came at the beginning.
They couldn't deduce that from looking at the Luchot.
Ah, so that's an interesting question. Which?
Oh, you get it in a sec. What? If you could just continue one more line, I'll be easier to answer.
Yes, but no, it's not just the Luchot. So it's true, the Luchot was smashed.
No, but the Luchot that exists.
But you had the Luchot Shniot.
But they weren't on display.
But there was access to them. And they also had the Sefer Torah.
Sefer Torah that we had.
Right? They had the first Sefer Torah that Moshe wrote, and then they had the 12 Sefer Torah that were parceled out to all the Shvatim, right? And this is not...
There were kings of Sefer Torah?
What?
Kings of Sefer Torah?
Yeah. This was not something that... there was no access to some kind of source. Vatut sofim v'tiknu p'tuchin be'emtza teva v'stumim b'sof teva. Right? So they made a takana that this is the way it should be. That the stumin, the sofiot, should be at the end, and meaning this set of letters should be at the end, and this set of letters should be at the beginning. Look at the Rashi. Well, let's look at all these Rashi. Look at the first Rashi. Bnei Sayu Omdin. No, Gimel Amad Aleph. Shahita Chakikatan Mishnei Evrehen. It went through both sides. Hilchach shar otiot yesh lehen makom davik. But each letter can work that way. Ela mem v'samich haita ba'avir. V'dafka b'stumim. And this is only relevant in the mem sofit. The samich is irrelevant. The samich is not part of this conversation. In the sense that it's not one of the mansapach letters. But it's relevant in terms of also requiring the nes for the material in the middle. Vefshar haya lo letaretzach derav chizda bistumin vechi itmar hach derabbi yirmiya biptuchin vahachi muchach beperek habone b'msechet shabbat elaha parichla milta deshavyula trevaihu. In other words, this could have answered which question? Is there two questions here?
One, did they change the...
One is, how could they have changed the letters? And the other was,
not knowing which is the
Sophie form.
Right. So this answers
that they didn't change it.
They didn't change it. Right? But in all cases, it is manavshach. So you want to say that the Nevi'im didn't invent the Otiot Sofiot, they just determined that the Otiot Sofiot... In other words, apparently it meant that before the Nevi'im, they were interchangeable. Right? It didn't matter. You could write it this way. You know, just think about it. In other words, when we were kids, we're all of us young enough to, you know, now, like, I find each year when I teach, all of my references are, everything is outdated. But when we were kids, we all learned penmanship. Right? And there was a right way to write each letter. But in reality, none of us write that way. I mean, my grandmother did. My grandmother was a secretary. She'd gone to secretarial school. She wrote the way that, you know, they taught them. But other people, none of us write that way. None of you write where each letter is formed looking like. Because, in fact, you can write a capital G this way, you can write a capital G that way, you can write a capital S this way, you can write a capital S that way. Right? They're all interchangeable.
Different fonts we have on the computer.
Right? So, right, there's a Q, a lowercase Q, right? You can write a lowercase Q like this, so you can write this Q, it curves around. Did you hear the interview with Henry Winkler?
Yes. Right.
Henry Winkler, you know, the Fonz, you know, for the past, you know, all these years since the Fonz, he's written like 35 children's books. I had no idea. And he apparently suffers from dyslexia, as does his son. And these books are printed in this in a kind of new font, which is anti-dyslexic. That it, all of the things that, like a B and a D and a Q and a G and all the letters that are so easily mixed up, the font is such that it has like this very subtle cue that make these things easy. I mean, also it's just easier for young kids when they learn how to read. But it was very interesting to listen to this interview. So maybe the Gemara is meaning that these letters, they were just two different ways to do it, and there was no nafkamina. You could have had a Sefer Torah this way, you could have had a Sefer Torah that way. And the Nevi'im were metakein that these five forms are in the beginning of the letter, and these five forms are at the end. Why would they have wanted that?
Why would they have wanted
the just kind of set it in stone? Pardon the expression. Yeah, because you can understand why they would not have liked the idea that there are certain letters that are joker's wild.
By the way, you do occasionally find some Sophie letters in the middle.
Yeah, these are, you know, in all of these kinds of... Yeah. I mean, all of the things in a Sefer Torah that are, you know, odd, like, you know, the places that have the dots and the places that have big letters and small letters and the places that have the upside-down nuns in Vayib and Soharon. Mirror image nuns. They're colloquially called the nunim hafuchim. All of those things... are none of those things, I should say. None of those things are posel. This happened in the caravan. There was a Sefer Torah that I don't remember which Sefer it was. There was a Sefer Torah that was missing the nuns on Vayhi ben Soharon. So whoever was laning thought it must be a psul, and they put the Sefer away, and they took out a new Sefer. And it turns out none of those typographical things.
That's a strange thing to leave out, because you figure you're a sofer. That's going to be one of your highlights.
Yeah, but apparently it was, even though it's nearly universal, it was not. This is an old sefer. I'm not sure where it came from. Anyway, we got it fixed. We had the nuns added in, but technically, it's not. None of these things are posel in a sefer Torah. So maybe it means that that's what they did. That they just set a kind of template for where each of them should be. Sof sof ela mitzvot. Shein navi atid lechadesh nevar me'ata. Ella shachachum v'chazru v'yisudu. So even that idea that they were interchangeable and the Nevi'im kind of set what you had to do, so even that seems to violate the idea of ve'ela mitzvot, that they can't change anything. So what happened? So this idea that we encounter from time to time in the Shas, that no, there was a set halacha, the tradition was forgotten, and the Nevi'im came, or the Anshei Knesset HaGadola came, and reinstated the original practice. Where else do we see this? We see that in Ktav Ashuri and Ktav Ivri.
Yeah.
That
there's a machloket about whether the Torah was given Ktav Ashuri or Ktav Ivri.
Right.
And actually, most of the Gedolim seem to say that some say it was given Ashuri, some say it was given Ivri, and some say it was given Ashuri, forgotten, and went to Ivri, and then later Ezra was Mechadesh and returned it to Ashuri, and one of their proofs is this Gemara.
Right.
However, there's the Yerushalmi, that the Yerushalmi equivalent of this Gemara says it's not Mem and Tamech, but Tet 9.
Because in the Ktav Ivri, original, those
nine
is, right.
is closed. It looks like the Ayin, the Hebrew Ayin, the first all looks like Ayin. It also led to letter O, so the Ktav, you can imagine that the Ayin would be closed in a, it's going to look like an I, it's going to leave letter O, it would be closed. So that can support the idea that maybe it was given in Ivri.
The Gemara in Brachos has the idea when it says that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola came and were metake in the Shmone Esrei. That contradicts the idea that the Shmone Esrei was mitukan by Shmuel HaKatan. No, the Shmuel HaKatan did it. I'm sorry, that Shmuel HaKatan came and was Matan. So how could it be? Because we already have this idea, the Gemara gives us a drashot of how it is. So no, it's not that they forgot the Shmone Esrei. It's they forgot the order. Now there's the Gemara in Brachot has this long drasha.
On the order.
On the progression of the themes of the, why this bracha comes before that bracha, etc. So that's what was forgotten and was reinstituted, was saved from oblivion. You have this idea that appears from time to time. That's
here is also, which is one of the things is the with like Yeshua Melech, and if it is time to save the Torah, which can also explain how they wouldn't have known why they would have to come and say what letters were, because if they didn't know, they didn't have it in front of them because they had lost it for that period.
Right. So that's what the Rashba says. The Rashba says, even according to the Havamina, they mamish forgot. So Beseda, go and look in the Sefer Torah. Right? You know, that idea that there were three Svarim in the Heichal, that there were three, proof texts, that if there was a Shaila in a Sefer Torah, like today we have the Tikkun. Right, even though in like the Tikkunim or in printed Chumashim, you can find a mistake.
I once found Pesach Ol Moed with
it. You found what?
Pesach, like Hey Samach Chet Ol Moed, instead of Petach.
But it's pretty rare. It's pretty rare. It's even rarer in newer editions of Sfarim to find typos of that nature. But in the Beis HaMikdash, they had three Sifrei Torah that were the authoritative editions, and if there was a machlokus between them, it was majority rules.
This is, by the way, a radical idea and kind of takes some of the wind out of the whole codes concepts.
Oh yes,
because it's not, we don't say we have the the Nusach, exact Nusach of the Torah that was given, like, what we said, we have a democratic rule. It could be that it wasn't the one that was actually, but
Well, again, it depends on...
Even regarding the Torah itself.
It depends on how you interpret that. In other words, you could say that the hand of Hashgacha is there to determine that we've preserved the authoritative one.
Then we could have the hand of Hashgacha enough to have this one.
Say that again?
The hand of Hashgacha would be enough to have just one. Wouldn't
no,
three?
Because you say that that's the... Hashgacha works through this method of, like the Goral Agra or something, that you have this idea of the two out of the three that you could compare.
There's only two or three letters there, and I would say the Torah that's in dispute.
Yeah, there's very... It's remarkable that... how the degree of integrity that was preserved in the text of the Chumash... throughout history, I mean, throughout millennia, it's really remarkable. Professor Weiss-Halivni's book, on this topic, which is called I forget the name of the book, but his book about Torah Mesinai and the integrity of the text, makes this point that, even if there are, slight differences between, between this Nusach and that Nusach, and David can tell us all about Rav Breuer and everything else. But despite that, the degree to which it's together, and Weiss-Halivni is careful to point out that there's not a single textual difference that makes any impact on Halacha L'maisa, which is, also remarkable.
Well, that's, a little debatable, because you could say that if you look at, let's say, the Septuagint, so there's things that are much more different, and it could be that those were actually, there are those
instead,
that claim.
We're going to get to the Septuagint.
No, but I think there are those that claim that it represents
that is not the position of the halachic community.
No, but say that. I'm just saying, within the halachic community, we have a consensus.
We have a kind of consensus on what the norm is.
But that consensus was not, it doesn't, there's no proof necessarily that consensus goes back, 3,000 years. That consensus goes back to the establishment of the
Masorah.
Of the Masorah, which was much, much later. And right. So people in the Shomronim, who would disagree with some of our things. I'm not saying that they have that they would say, you can say that from your time, from the 800s or whatever, the 700s, when you finally...
Did you want to say something about the actual historical development about the Mantzapach?
I was not able to find too much more than what I just said now about that particular sugya. They think it came later, basically. The academic approach is that these letters came later. Tavashuri came later.
From an academic point of view, why would these letters have different forms when they appear at the end of a word?
I didn't see that, but my guess would be that it's similar to English, how you have certain flares when you finish a word. That just makes it more clear. They also, a lot of ancient scripts wrote things very closely together, so if there wasn't spaces, it'd be easier to know when a word ended, maybe.
But why would you need that by only these five? That would be true for all the other letters also.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that I can't tell you. But you could say that certain letters, even like we have languages where the certain letters just naturally kind of flow out, or maybe we get it mixed up. If that history of the English language podcast, which you introduced me to many, many years ago, is now up to the point where we're talking about how the English worked out and why they're still making
noises. I stopped listening to all the time.
But why we have certain letters in English. We have, it's not the same exact thing, but you have a J that goes down, and which used to be an I, and again, there was reasons to see would be easy to distinguish.
Said, but there's only letters. One today. There's only one J.
No.
Although we do have a difference. We have, and as in English, there's a difference that you have capital letters.
Which is similar, might serve a similar purpose. You have to make distinctions easier between words. So maybe some letters would have been more similar if you didn't have, at the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems probably Revelation Restored.
Revelation Restored. Revelation Restored. That's what it's called. Okay. Now the Gemara gives us another statement. Omer Rabbi Yirmiya ve'item Rabbi Chiya bar Abba. Targum shel Torah. I mean, it's interesting. These are all, grouped together just because they are all statements where it's either this or that. But they're all, there's some, common thread to all of them. Targum shel Torah, unklus hagerim ru. So we all know about Unklus. Targum shel Torah Unklus Hager Amru Mipi Rabbi Eliezer Rabbi Yoshua. So what does it mean? He said the Targum. He wrote the Targum into Aramaic. Mipi Rabbi Eliezer Rabbi Yoshua. What does that mean? Yeah, that in other words, that according to their all translation by definition is interpretation to one degree or another. There's no such thing as one-to-one translation. That's the nature of language. That's the nature of this is something that I wrestle with. You know, people ask me all the time, how is it possible to translate Agnon? You know, that's a kind of very natural Israeli chauvinism. You can't translate Agnon. You can translate other things, but you can't translate Agnon. But that's no different than the Russians think you can't translate Tolstoy, and the in London they can't imagine you can translate Shakespeare. To a certain degree, it's true that you can't translate. But it's not true. But it's true that all translations do some kind of
interpretation,
and by and this is particularly true in Agnon. In Agnon, there's a tremendous amount of he never said something one way if saying it the other way could transmit on two simultaneous wavelengths. That's his ability to write and, you know, on different levels in a way that each line carries multiple meanings.
Almost like a pun, in the sense of it.
Yeah, in the way that you can't translate a pun, right. And that's true in his working and weaving in rabbinic sources. And it's true just in the way that, you know, you read him and you're trying to figure something out and he's saying different things at the same time. Shamar v'zachor b'dibur echad la'avdil elef avdeldos. A translator doesn't have that luxury. You can either translate it this way, or you can translate it that way. And you have to make a choice. There are a lot of times where he's talking about something I taught the other night. He's talking about Avinu. And it's not clear if Avinu there is our father, Tati, or he's talking about Avinu Shebashamayim. So when you're talking about, in English, it's conventional to translate a reference to God with a capital letter. That is, if I was talking about our Father who art in heaven, where it's clear that we're talking about the God, I would capitalize F. If I'm talking about my Father who came home from work today, I would write it with lowercase f. I have to make a choice. I can't maintain the ambiguity that's there in the original.
Right, I mentioned to you once that there was a similar issue in translating Harry Potter into Hebrew.
Yeah.
Because the translator didn't know what was, you know, she didn't know what was going to happen. Like, I think we was talking about translating the sixth book or something, and she was saying she didn't know what was going to happen in the seventh book, and there was a clue at the end, and you didn't know whether it was referring to a person, but you didn't know whether it was going to be talking
Zachar Nekeva.
Right. And she had to, and the translator had to say something. She
right.
didn't have it be nothing, and any clue would give it away.
Right. Right. That's a perfect example, right? Where you translate from one language that is ungendered to another language that is gendered. That's true in an Agnon has a story called Bidmiya Meha, where it's the only case in all of his writings where the narrator is a woman. And you don't know that. And as you start reading, if you've read Agnon, or even if you haven't read Agnon, you start reading a book until you have reason to understand otherwise. We generally assume that a male author writes with a male narrator. It doesn't have to be, but that's the... So you read, you get like three pages in until you discover that the narrator is a young woman. And that's signaled in the Hebrew by using, I forget, a gendered word. But in English, it just translates as you. And as you don't, in the Hebrew, another character says to the narrator of the story, who takes action in the story, v'at. Right? So, how do you translate in English? As if you translate it pshuto kamashmo, you lose the fact that he's signaled gender. That the gender, which makes the reader then pause and say, "Oh, wait a second, who is this narrator?" Right. So all translation is a form of.
Sarabatevit, right? That's one of them.
So this idea that the Gemara will get to this about the Targum HaShivim, that there's something tragic about the Targum HaShivim. Now that might be because the Targum HaShivim was done under duress, because a whole variety of things. But the idea that translating itself is problematic. You know, that was the miracle. The Gemara discusses all of the specific cases in the Targum HaShivim where they intentionally deviated from the Pshuto Shel Mikra in order to avoid polemical problems. That's, you know, Rav Huttner said. It wasn't such a miracle. What did they do? They took 70 chachamim, they put them in 70 different rooms, and they all came up with the same product. So Rav Huttner said, that's not such a miracle. If they would have put 70 Jews in the same room and they would have come up with one product, that would have been a real miracle.
They didn't know that.
So Omer Rabbi Yirmi, Omer Rabbi Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi. So, and what does it mean? He said he translated it according to the pshat that he had learned from Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua. Tirgum shel Nevi'im, Yonatan ben Uziel amru. Mipi Chagai Zachariah Malachi. Now wait a second. How could that be? When did Chagai Zachariah Malachi live?
The
beginning of Beit Sheni. Right? And when did Yonatan ben Uziel live?
He was a
disciple of Hillel. Yeah. Right? Long time after. So what does it mean? It must mean that he did it not mipihem, but according to their tradition. V'nizdaza eretz Yisrael arba meot parsal arba meot parsa. And when he translated the Torah, the Nevi'im, there was an earthquake. Eretz Yisrael shook 400 amot in this direction and 400 amot in that direction. I think, isn't that, that's the measurement of Eretz Yisrael? Rashi says it someplace.
Parsa.
What? Oh, I said Parsa, not Amut.
Small countries,
but not that small. Right? Rashi someplace. Where does Rashi say that? Maybe in. You know, you should know every Rashi in Chumash Balpe. But I'll admit that I don't. But I know that Rashi says this someplace. That the midot of Eretz Yisrael are arba mod prasot. And the point is, there was an earthquake. It was a meaning. Was it a good thing or a bad thing? A bad thing. Yatzta bat kol v'amra mihuze ve'zehu. In other words, I told you the Gemara here is sensitive to the fact this is Masechet Megillah. Mihuze shegilas sitrai livnei adam.
Is it okay?
Why?
This reminds me that when I was, you know, if you look in the art scroll, Shir Shirim, they, unlike the Birnbaum, they don't translate literally. And as you know, little kids would always look
somebody,
to see if, like,
somebody went, somebody with the art scroll Shir Shirim, subtitled 101 Ways Not to Say the Word Breast.
Right.
Yeah.
The assumption is, similar to the assumption here, that what, no one could read Hebrew.
No, in other words, what does this mean?
So you could, the art school is assuming it was so terrible, you wouldn't have the Hebrew included as well, because anyone who knew Hebrew would be able to figure these things out on their own. So here what? All this was translated from Hebrew to
Hebrew, then it's okay.
That's what here do. So what are you saying?
No, we have elsewhere the idea that there were parts of the Torah that were not censored, but were limited to certain crowds. Is when we say that there's certain things that are read publicly, but not read. And as in the days of old, how did it work? You'd read an aliyah, it's a machlokas, so you read an aliyah, and then the miturgaman would read the tirgum. Or you do posuk. But there were certain passages where the targum wasn't read. So I understand. They're reading the. Look, nowadays, this is not understandable to us because.
We live in Israel.
Well, because we don't understand Aramaic, right? But what did it mean? It meant that they were. You'd read the pasuk in Hebrew. So first of all, in Hebrew, okay. So there were always people someplace who knew Hebrew. But who were those people? People. They wouldn't necessarily have to be chachamim, meaning members of the Sanhedrin, but they were people that were more initiate to wisdom, and the simple folk. So we don't need to spell everything out for them, because a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. It will lead them to superficial understanding, and superficial understanding leads to mistakes, and etc. So certain things would not be translated publicly. Things that, I don't know, you don't want the kinder to know, things that have mystical implications, etc. So what does it mean, Strelevnei Adam? So either Levnei Adam, the Anashim HaPshutim, who are not ready to be initiated to certain things. Or
the Goyim,
which seems to have been the problem of the Septuagint, of translating into Greek. Right? I mean, this is related to the sugya of teaching Torah to non-Jews. Right? The Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Nun Tet says that, you know, Morasha Kehilat Yaakov, that the Torah is a gift to the Jews. And there's a problem in principle, even though there's a lot of different ways around it, there's a problem in principle of transmitting Torah to the non-Jews. So first, generally we say that means the Torah Shebal Peh, not the Torah Shebichtav. And it depends on how it's taught and how is it, like, you know. I mean, there were some people at foot, you can't write Sfarim in English or in other languages, because people can access that. When Rav Teitz, Zichron Alevracha, in Elizabeth, New Jersey, you know, was one of the great rabbinic figures in America in the early mid-20th century. So he used to have a radio show where he taught Gemara on the radio, on Motzei Shabbat. I think it was like a shiur, which was broadcast over the radio. It was like the first person to do that. It was like the pioneer of Web Yeshiva. So so there's a shiur, you can look it up in the Igris Moshe. He asked the shiur of Rav Moshe, can he do this? Because anybody can open the radio. The Goyim can also open the radio and listen to the Gemara Shir. And is this a problem? So Rav Moshe's matir. Because Rav Moshe Feinstein's matir, because that's not called teaching Torah to Goyim. Because that's passive. You know, like if a non-Jew were like outside, like listening through the open window, so that's not a violation of teaching Torah to Goyim. So what is the problem of teaching Torah to Goyim? I don't know. You have to like look and see. But in principle,
in principle,
like, you know, like to go, and this has nothing to do with Jewish-Christian dialogue, right? But in principle, like to go and give a Gemara Shir to a group of non-Jews, you know, that's not there to kind of like with some apologetic or some polemic or some, you know, whatever. But like Torah Lishma, to go and teach Torah Lishma to a group of non-Jews, Taka would be a problem. So maybe there's an element of that here. But it could be that we're not talking about the non-Jews. It could be that we're talking about Tiyidin, who are not, you know, they'll be led astray through a misunderstanding. So the Baskol comes and says, you know, how could you do this? How could you reveal the secrets of the Nevi'im? So Amad Yonasan ben Uziel al Raglav va'amar, Ani hu shegaliti sitrecha. And they say, who did it? He said, I did it. What is this? What does this remind you of? This Gemara? Yatzta bat kol, amad al raglav, amar. Yeah, lo bashamayimi. It's the same. There's a kind of template for these kinds of Gemaras of confronting a bas kol. Galui v'yadu lefnecha shelo lichvodi asiti, velo lichvod beit abba, ela lichvod chasiti. So he says back to Kadosh Baruch Hu, Yonas ben Uziel says he back to Kadosh Baruch Hu. Right, I did it, but I didn't do it for my own ego or for my father's, you know. I did it for you to spread Torah. Shelo yarbu machloket b'Yisrael. Shelo yarbu machloket b'Yisrael. So you see, Rashi says lefaresh mikraot hastumim. There's all types of psukim in the Nevi'im. That you ever try learning Navi? So. You don't have Rashi. I mean, you have Rashi, but not like you have Rashi on Chumash. right? It's there's a lot of things in Nevi'im that you just don't, you get there. Like in the Torah, so it's so well worked over. There's not much in Chumash where you can't figure out the Pshuto Shel Mikra. But in Navi, there are all types of things you run up against.
Masa Merkava. Yeah. Discussion Gemara, you can learn it with.
Right, well, so that's the Gemara I was referring to. But no, but even, not just Masa Merkava, where we don't understand the deep, deep, deep meaning. There are places in Navi we don't understand the Pshuto Shel Mikra. Masa Merkava, you understand the Pshuto Shel Mikra. You understand what the words mean. You don't understand what the concepts mean.
To put the JPS, meaning of Hebrew uncertainty.
Yes. Right, there's in the JPS translation. There's all types of for that said. They have that in Chumash also, but more in Navi. So because of that, it led to machloket. So Yonos Ben Uzila, I was doing this in order to minimize machloket because people don't know what the psukim mean, and we have to translate them because translating them is a form of interpreting them. V'od bikesh legalot targum shel ketuvim, and Yonos ben Uziel had also. Yeah, it's not clear. Like, had he written it, and he was gonez, or he was planning on writing a targum for the ketuvim. So yatzta batko v'amra lo dayecha, maspik. Okay, we accept your ta'ana about the targum of Nevi'im, but we will not allow you to publish the Targum of the Ksuvim. Why? My taima? Mishum de'it ba'ketz Mashiach. Because in the Ketuvim, there are hidden secrets. And they're meant to be hidden. And if you translate them, you're going to reveal them. Where's that? So presumably we're talking about Sefer Daniel.
That's strange.
Mm-hmm. You think?
Well, I was saying it's strange because Sefer Daniel is anyway written there, right? So like...
If, yeah.
It's the only one that doesn't have a targum.
Yeah, it would need a targum. We're obviously talking about people who speak Aramaic. That's the one part they can do.
Right. So, yeah, and in Hanami, but the targum that we do have on the pseudo-Jonathan targum, right, who was not written by Yonos ben Uziel. There is a targum on Ksuvim that was written later.
Much later.
But there's no targum on Daniel because it's principally written in Aramaic anyway.
For the interpretation and after the
yeah,
target.
So presumably, they didn't allow, the Baskol didn't allow Yonos ben Uziel to translate the Ksuvim because he would have also done a Tirgum of, like they have now today, they have, what's the name of that Chumash? There's a Chumash that translates the Torah into Hebrew. The Tanakh Ram. It translates the Tanakh into contemporary Hebrew. So presumably, that's the kind of translation he would have done. Wait, the targum shel Torah v'anklus hager amru v'ha. Okay, besides, so we'll. All right, so we'll meet again after Purim.